Hello everyone! Welcome to the International Society of Pharmacoeconomics and Outcomes Research, also known as ISPOR. This is a Health Economics and Policy podcast series from the ISPOR student chapter at the University of Calgary. My name is Lisa Grisachin and I'm a PhD student at the University of Calgary. The title of today's podcast is The Bridge Between Health Economics and Policy. Today we have as our guest speaker, Dr. Fiona Clement. Dr. Clement is an associate professor at the University of Calgary and the director of the Health Technology Assessment Unit within the O'Brien Institute of Public Health. Dr. Clement's experience includes drug and non-drug technology assessment and health policy development. Hello, Dr. Clement. How are you today?
I'm well. Thank you, Louisa. I'm excited to be talking to you.
Today, we'd like to broadly discuss the topic health economics and the role of health economics when informing health policy actions.
That's a great question, Louisa. So health policy is very broad. You can think about it as maybe the rules or the regulations, or some people might call it the guidelines, that set out health policy, I guess, like the actions and what's going to happen. When we think about health policy, we often talk about three different levels. So we might talk about the micro level, which is the interaction between a doctor and an individual patient. So right at the bedside, for example, there are micro policies about the kinds of treatments that you can give at certain times, who is allowed to give what kinds of treatments to what kinds of patients, how often the patient will be moved from the ward to somewhere else. And that's really the micro health policy environment. We have the meso level, which for many healthcare systems is kind of the healthcare delivery organization. So for us here, it would be Alberta Health Services. In other places, it might be the hospital level or perhaps like a mid-tiered governance structure. And there you're talking about policies that really set out the agreed upon actions within that area. And then the last level is kind of macro health policy. And here we're talking about the government regulations. So in a single payer universal healthcare system like ours, that would be the provincial government setting out macro level policies, or the federal government setting out policies that say, you know, this is what must be publicly funded within the healthcare system, or this is what an accredited body can offer in terms of services. So really, there's the three levels, and ideally you have them all working together towards the same goals, and that produces like the most productive healthcare systems, I think.
Excellent. Thank you for giving us a brief overview on the topic. Now, I'd like to ask you, how can health economics inform policy?
Well, money is always at the table. So if it's not the first thing that's asked, it's always the second. So you might be proposing a new policy, and for sure, the question of the administrator or the decision maker or the government analyst is going to be, what's this going to cost me? How is this going to impact the resources that we have? What are the expected benefits from this? Particularly when you're talking about those macro level policies, economics and the current market forces will be a big concern for government. So economics is a really important field to have at the table when you're developing health policy, to be thinking about not only the resources that are going to be used, but what is the expected impact? And then also informing conversations around, well, if we didn't use the resources here, how else could we? So what's the opportunity cost? What's the trade-offs that we're making by investing in this technology, for example, versus that technology? So health economics has to be at the table.
So Dr. Clement, I'd like to ask you, what is the process for policy?
Louisa, that's a great question. And there's a line that's bantered around in policy communities where it's like, there's two things you never want to see: how a sausage is made and how health policy is made. So it's a little bit ugly, I think, the process itself, but and each process, and depending on the table and the level of policy being made, there the process would be different. But the process that I've seen is often we'll start with a request, so a recognition that we want to make policy around a particular topic, and then a request for as much evidence as possible on the question. And so then you know, the HTA producer or the evidence synthesis group takes that back, spends time looking at systematic reviews, synthesizing evidence from as many different perspectives and sources as possible, understanding, like, if somebody else has made policy in this area, what are other players doing? Particularly in our Canadian context, we look at what other provinces are doing. Is there federal policy that we need to fall in line with? And then take that information back to a broad stakeholder group that is usually convened at the request of the government. And they put those tables together to try and represent as broad an interest group or as broad voices as they can. And in some cases, I've seen a series of policy conversations happen, so where the stakeholder group comes together multiple times to really hash out the issues. And sometimes the government has proposed a straw dog of the policy, and the stakeholder groups will really say, well, this will work, that wouldn't work, you know, it's the right idea, but here's the implementation issues with that. And then in some cases, depending on the policy and how engaged and how present the patient or the public voice needs to be, after those policy tables have happened, there might be a public consultation period. So either through town halls, for example, or in one big piece of policy that we just had, there was a massive website set up for people to comment, and surveys were sent out, and there was a very, very active public engagement piece. And then that piece would kind of go back to the government, and they would table their final piece of framework. So it's not as clean as that in all policy development, but that's one of the processes that I've seen that I think was very exciting. And what I particularly liked about it was the inclusion of so many voices along the entire journey, as opposed to just at the end when the policy is tabled and then you're hearing from the stakeholders, or worse yet, you develop and you implement the policy and then you hear from the stakeholders. So In the process I just described, what I really liked about it was the continued engagement of stakeholders and the public.
Perfect. And what are the challenges in getting evidence into practice?
This is so contextual, Louisa. I think whilst there are common challenges, there are very localized challenges, I guess, to the specific healthcare system. So the common ones you might see are kind of culture. So is there a culture within the healthcare system or within the policy environment of using evidence to form policies? And, you know, some systems have a more readiness, I guess, to have evidence-based policies or evidence-informed policies than other areas. Sometimes one of the big challenges that you have getting evidence into practice is that there isn't the right kinds of evidence for you to inform practice. So thinking about some of the policy files I've worked on, the policy is going to be made at a certain time, and my job is to put the best possible evidence in front of the decision makers by that time. And sometimes when that window is very short, you are stuck using already published evidence or already published economic models, or kind of extrapolating what you think will happen based on kind of what we know about theories. And so sometimes that's one of the big challenges, is that we just don't have evidence to inform this practice change. Some of the other big challenges are, one, of course, change is hard. And so depending on the kinds of policies that you're trying to implement and the kinds of levers that you have or the tools that you have to support people in the change, that's also a very, very tough space. So there's a lot of challenges.
Great. And could you provide an example of a real life situation where health economics was successful in shaping health policy?
Yeah. So for us here in Canada, and I think it's shared in other contexts as well, we were really challenged by the new drugs for hepatitis C that came onto the market in Canada in about 2013. So these are drugs that are essentially a cure for hepatitis C, which is a virus that infects bodies, and many people remain asymptomatic with the disease for many, many years, whereas others will develop liver disease and have severe complications from the impact on their liver. But these drugs essentially have viral clearance rates at 12 weeks of zero, so your body has completely cleared the virus. It is a cure. And, you know, on a scientific side, a huge breakthrough in the way we understand the hepatitises and those kinds of viruses. The only catch, of course, is that these drugs came into the market at a very expensive price point. So in Canada, we saw them enter the market at about $50,000 per treatment course, which is very expensive, given that hepatitis C, and again, remembering many people infected may be asymptomatic and not know that they're infected, we estimate prevalence rates of, you know, from 0.75 of the Canadian population all the way up to like 3 or 4% prevalence, depending on the exact number and the different kinds of subgroups that you're looking at in the population. So certainly unlikely that we would be able to afford to pay for everybody who was infected with hepatitis C. So then alongside that is the question of, okay, should we screen for people? And again, many people would be unaware that they were carriers, and so should we screen the entire population, for example, as part of a general physical? Or we could set up screening clinics and advertise, say, come on down and we'll screen you. Or we could do some kind of targeted screening programs. And again, one of the foundational principles of screening is if you don't have any intention of treating the person, you should really be questioning whether or not you should be screening them. Because if you're going to screen them, tell them that they have disease that perhaps they were unaware of they had before, and then say, but we're not going to offer you the cure off the public purse. You know, for the average person, finding $50,000 to pay for a treatment course is unrealistic, and, you know, not in line with the expectations that we have for the Canadian healthcare system. So this was a really tough policy conversation, and there's really the two questions of who are we going to pay for the drug for, and how are we going to match that, if we do match it at all, to a screening program to have people who are asymptomatic be identified. And so recognizing that we knew right off the bat that screening everybody in the population and treating everybody in the population was not an option, we could not afford that, how do we use the principles of health economics, so looking at best value, best return on investment, and interweave that as one component of the policy conversation to ensure that we're providing access to the drug for the right group of people, as well as screening the right group of people so that we can match those things and we're not finding people that we have no intention of covering the drug for. So it was a really intense, if I may use that word, policy conversation where economics was at the forefront, along with very strong considerations of, for example, vulnerable groups, people's ability to pay for the drug or to get private insurance coverage, which is an option here in Canada if you don't have public coverage, and really a very uncomfortable conversation, if I may, around like where hepatitis C fits in line with other kinds of diseases that we're seeing very expensive treatments for. And by that I mean, you know, $50,000 per treatment course is not that unusual for some of the cancer drugs, and really having a conversation about, okay, if we're going to allocate $50,000 towards someone's healthcare, recognizing that for the largest burden of hepatitis C is among people who are unstably housed. Our Aboriginal population has a very large prevalence, and then our newly immigrated population also has a high prevalence. So, you know, if we're going to spend this kind of money on the care needs of those people, is treating their hepatitis C really their most pressing need? Or is there another way that we could use that money to improve their health even more? So it was a really rich conversation where health economics was an absolute must at the table to ensure that everything was kind of balanced and weighed, and more than just the cost, but actually we were talking about value.
Wow, that's very interesting. That it brings us to the conclusion of today's episode. So thank you, Dr. Clement, for your time and insights. We hope you enjoyed this episode and stay tuned with the Health Economics and Policy Podcast.